You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, with COVID restrictions being widely lifted, Jen White asks, how do we respect the needs of the estimated 7 million Americans who are immunocompromised? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, whether you lost a loved one, a job, or a pivotal milestone like your graduation ceremony, just about everyone has been affected by COVID-19. And grieving those losses isn't a simple process. We may try to get over it, to get back to normal, to find closure. But our next guest says closure is a myth. And as tempting as it may be to try to forget the things we missed, our guest today says we should instead live with and embrace those losses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with a loss during the pandemic? Are you willing to share that story? Do you know someone else who lost a loved one? Do you feel like you're able to get over the challenges you faced? How have you made a new life after that loss? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Pauline Boss is Professor Emeritus of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. Her latest book is The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. She's also from Wisconsin and a UW-Madison graduate. Pauline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
I want to start with this core idea. I think there's this idea out there in our culture that after a loss, you know, a loss of a loved one, maybe the goal is to find closure, to get back to normal. And if we don't get there, we're doing it wrong. Talk about why, please, that's a myth.
It's a myth because it's not possible once you've had a relationship with someone, once you've loved someone, that when they're gone, it's not possible to close the door on them. Most people remember them, keep them in their hearts and mind, do things in their honor, and tell stories about them and so on. So the normal way is to remember the person who is gone from death, for example, instead of closing the door. And even if you look back at the sages who taught us, from Freud to Kubler-Ross, in their personal writings, they also indicate that they didn't have closure on their own personal losses, even though in their professional writings, they seem to tell us that detachment was the thing, at least Freud did, and Kubler-Ross essentially had presented the five stages, which were deeply misunderstood. In general, we want meaning instead of closure. We want certainty of where our loved ones are buried, of whether or not they're dead or alive, and that means with ambiguous loss, you're never sure if the person you care about is going to come back or not, as they used to be. And that can be a case of soldiers missing in action or kidnapped children. That's physical ambiguous loss. Or it can be psychological ambiguous loss, is when someone is sitting right in front of you, they're present, but they don't know who you are. So there are different kinds of losses. One is one with certainty, that is when there's a death certificate, and the other is when they're missing in mind or body, and that's an ambiguous loss. In either case, there is no closure.
You include the phrase ambiguous loss in the title of your book. And with COVID, it seems like that added a whole new category that you talk about a lot in the book, where a person may have passed away because of COVID or something else, maybe in a hospital setting, and you couldn't be with them. And the opportunities to mark their passing in the way we usually would with a funeral or something like that was taken away from so many people. Did that add to this challenge of ambiguous loss?
Yes. Now, not being able to have a funeral, the ritual of a funeral, is a psychological ambiguous loss, but it also has a physical component because the gathering of friends and family is usually a comfort to the person who is mourning, and that couldn't be done. But there were other losses, many, many losses during the pandemic, and I think part of our anxiety has been the result of the uncertainty about, are we safe? Can we trust the world we live in to protect us? And can we trust the people sitting next to us on a bus as to whether or not they might pass the virus? So these are all ambiguous losses. And then, of course, there were many clear-cut losses, many quantifiable losses, such as loss of income, loss of a job, and things like that. So during this pandemic, during this difficult 2 years or more, people have had many losses, and I think they're not aware of it, which would normalize then the feelings of anxiety that they have. I think that feeling anxious in the past 2 years was a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
I think a lot of people during the pandemic have had that sense like, okay, yes, things are bad now. We're going to get back to normal. It's going to be over in the rearview mirror, and then we'll get back to normal life. And that, in many ways, keeps receding and getting pulled away from us. How do we create a normal life in a time of ongoing uncertainty like that?
I write about both and thinking in the book. The best way to cope with this kind of stress that we're having now, and I think still for a little while longer, although I hope it's receding, and that is by thinking both and. You know, I both think this is terrible and I can manage it. I both am restricted in what I can do, and I can learn some new things meantime. I both am restricted from going to concerts and large-scale gatherings, and I can still have contact with friends in sidewalk cafes. So this both-and thinking is the way to reduce stress during a time of great pressure from the outside. When something else is controlling your life, like a virus, like a war, those kinds of things, then you need to find something smaller that you can control in your life. So I think we all can do that. And I believe that's why during the height of the pandemic, many people were baking bread, because you could control that for a couple hours. You knew what you were doing. You controlled the outcome. You enjoyed the outcome. And those kinds of things are very good coping mechanisms for when the outside context of your life is in chaos.
We're talking to Pauline Boss about her new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd be willing to share a story of a loss in your life, a loved one maybe, or loss of normal life in one way or another, how you've worked with that. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I have had a terrible time with grief. We lost two kitties during COVID. Mm. And one to cancer, and one to a brain tumor. And I just collapsed. I couldn't stop shaking. I've never had medication to control any kind of emotional thing like that. And I actually needed to have medication at an emergency room because my husband was terrified. And it was, you know, I've read three books about grief, and see, the first cat, it was sudden. His cancer was rapidly growing, and he passed very suddenly when we took him in. It was severe. It was, you know, he had to be euthanized. And the second cat, he was getting sick, and then he would get better, and then he was getting sick, but he never quite got all the way better. And it took a long time of probably 6 months of nursing, you know, taking him to the vet, figuring it out, helping him. And when he passed, the vet figured that he was, the brain tumor, when it was growing, was causing the symptoms. And then when it stopped growing, he would seem to get better. And so it was, you combine that with COVID, which has made me terribly anxious. And then the former president, that was just fear all the time.
Yordis, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry you went through that. Pauline, with a series of losses like that, What can we? How do we start to try to get out of that the darkest part of that?
Yeah, I'm very sorry for such losses, and what she really described was a pile up of losses.
Right.
And we call that stress pile up also. What it does after a while, especially if you have so much piled on top of one another, it makes us feel helpless. And helplessness is not a good thing for a human being. And so you probably need to see somebody for help with learning how to cope with these helpless feelings. But meanwhile, what I write about is mastery. We are a nation of people, at least in Western culture, who like to master situations. We like to master problems and find cures for the things we love, for our pets and our people that we love. We like to master and fix things. And when we can't, we feel helpless. And so I think it's useful for you to think about this as something that you did the best you could, but you couldn't fix it. The same with the pandemic, the same with politics, and unfortunately the same with your two kitties. And so sometimes we fail, and we have to allow ourselves that possibility that we work hard, we do the best we can, and we still can't solve the problem. The pandemic has taught us something. It was an invisible enemy out there around us, very dangerous and deadly. And at first, we could not control it at all, at least not until the scientists came up with vaccine. You still have to find something you can control in your life. For example, putting on a mask, getting a vaccine were very helpful things to control. And what you did by going to the vet and doing the best you could, you too did the best you could to control. And now and then, we still have a loss because of that. Don't blame yourself. Many times, the blame is on an illness. The blame is in the context. Externalize the blame. Don't take it on your own shoulders. That's too much.
Yordis, thanks for being willing to share that with us. Pauline Boss is with us, Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, author of the book we're talking about, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you or someone you know lose a loved one during COVID? What strategies are you using to try to process that loss? Does it ever get easier? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Pauline Boss about her new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. Before I go back to our callers, Pauline, you apply some of your ideas about grief and loss to racial trauma and racial injustice in the United States as you were writing this, not just COVID, but the murder of George Floyd in your city of Minneapolis. How do you apply your thinking to this vast historical situation?
Well, I began at the University of Wisconsin in Madison studying ambiguous loss on a family basis. As I said, the wives of soldiers missing in action, and then the families of loved ones who had Alzheimer's disease. What I'm realizing now that it can also be on a community and a national and a global level. It can be the larger family, if you will, the family of the community. And what I noticed during the George Floyd killing, that there has been injustice amongst the black families for so many, I would say, centuries, hundreds of years since slavery, when the families were sold apart from one another on auction blocks. And that trauma of ambiguous loss, of not knowing where your children were or not knowing where your parents were or your mate, that trauma has been passed on down through the generations, and there has been no acknowledgement of it. You can't cope with something until it has a name, until you know what it is. And I think the ambiguous loss of what happened to the families of the slaves way back when is still with us today, and we need to face it. We need to acknowledge also the genocide of the Native Americans and all the other kinds of separations of families that we have done. We can't just bury it. And those that happen in our neighborhood, we have to face them. And what is called for is major change, major systemic change in how we interact as a community, as a human family.
Let's go back to our callers now. Emily is with us in Green Bay. Emily, hello.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you guys could touch on how the COVID pandemic affected people's mental health. My close friend completed suicide because they felt so lonely and didn't have anyone to talk to during these times. Do you have any information or resources you're able to provide?
Emily, I'm sorry. Thank you for calling in. I'm sorry for the loss of your friend. Pauline, the loss of connection there was a key element, it sounds like, for Emily's friend. How do we make sure we stay connected even in a tough time?
Yes, I'm so sorry about that loss. It was very difficult during this long period of COVID to stay connected with friends. And many of us learned to use technology to do that for the first time, Zoom and so on. But still, there were many people who didn't have broadband and many people who didn't know how to use the technology or didn't have computers. And what I find with the younger people is that they like to text, and older people don't because they want to use their voices and talk on the phone. So that sometimes older people didn't talk with anyone for weeks at a time. So you had to sort of figure out another way to stay connected. In my apartment building, for example, some younger people down the hall, they would go to the farmer's market, but I wouldn't because I'm 87 and I was high risk. I would find a bunch of vegetables in a bag on my door. Now, they didn't talk to me, but that was a lovely piece of communication by having vegetables dropped at my door. And so I knew that someone cared nearby. But I hope this, that now that things are easing up a bit, that we have neighborhood groups, that you have friendship groups, that you have book groups, that you have athletic groups, walking groups, because we are social animals and we need to talk with each other. And it's very important for you now to go out and have some two or three other people that you like to spend time with, like-minded people, that you can be with several times a week. It's time to be social again. It's necessary for human health.
Thanks again for calling in, Emily. Mark joins us now in Greenville. Mark, hi.
Hi there. All right, so my question is sort of about, so we've had this heightened anxiety from the pandemic, and I'm sort of questioning why sometimes, like, past experiences of trauma all of a sudden are brought up because of other incidents happening now.
Mark, thanks for that call. That makes sense. I think in some ways we're in a tough time, and maybe something from years ago rears up again, Pauline.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The caller was very wise about that. And what happens is, if we've had trauma early in our life and we haven't dealt with it, we haven't had help with it, even if we were children, it's still with us. And then maybe a decade or two later, along comes another event, and that will bring back the echo of that first trauma. So I think I think we need to talk about our experiences early on, all the losses we have had, the clear losses, the ambiguous losses, the ones you can't put your finger on. Find somebody to talk to, a peer, a grief group, a recreational group, or a therapist, because it's very important to deal with the traumas we've had early in life, because they will rear their ugly head again when we have a current trauma like we've had now.
Mark, thanks for that call. We just have a minute left. Pauline, you're very helpful about how we can tap into our resilience. Can you leave us just in a minute with your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we're more resilient than we think. And you should check your own experience these past 2 years. Haven't you learned something new? And if you're still standing, you should pat yourself on the back for getting through a worldwide pandemic, and for learning something, and for, I hope, being stronger for the experience that you've had. Suffering actually can make us stronger. At least you need to know that you've learned something from it and that you are stronger than you think. And so are your neighbors. And so the empathy for them and the empathy for yourself is very important once we're coming out of this tough time.
Pauline, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome.
Pauline Boss is the author of the new book, The Myth of Closure, Ambiguous Loss in a Time of Pandemic and Change. You can find a link to her book and more info at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're like me, you might fall into a rut when you're cooking for the family. Food Friday is coming to the rescue with the author of the Secret Ingredient Cookbook. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, mask requirements are ending around the country. We'll talk to a Wisconsin doctor about precautions that we might still want to take. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a big test for NATO. But how exactly does the military alliance work? An expert on European security joins the show, and you can join in with your thoughts and questions. First 2 years into the pandemic, most states are going mask-free. There's only one state left that still has a mask mandate in place, Hawaii, and it's set to expire later this month. The CDC also put out new guidelines that only recommend masks for certain individuals rather than mask mandates for entire communities. Some public health experts say this may have come too soon, with the possibility of new variants bringing case numbers back up. Others have pointed to the fact that immunocompromised people are still at serious risk and rely on others to stay safe. We're talking about the end of mask mandates at state and local levels, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about wearing your mask these days? Do you still wear it or not? If you do, when and where? What affects that decision? Have you put them away for now, but you're keeping them handy for what and when? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you or someone in your family are immunocompromised, have a particular risk related to COVID-19, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Janina Smith is an associate professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, the vast majority of states have lifted mask mandates. So have most local governments that still had them here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about that shift and what it means?
Absolutely. So we experienced one of the largest peaks of infection and unfortunately also of death over the fall and early winter. But as expected, based on how COVID's performed in other countries, we had a rapid drop. And currently, case counts in Dane County and in Wisconsin have dropped quite a bit. So in that setting of individuals either having been vaccinated and boosted or of having had COVID infection, for most people, the risk of developing COVID has gone down.
If somebody asks you now just individually, hey, doc, when do you think I ought to wear a mask? What kind of things do you tell them?
Well, I think it's very important to consider their own health status, but also the status of the community. So persons who are vaccinated, have had their boosters, are otherwise healthy, when there's low case rates, they can certainly participate in mask-free activities. I am a specialist in patients who have compromised immune systems. And for my patients, the risk is simply too great to go without a mask. So when you're considering these two things together, I do think that there are public spaces that my patients need to go to, that it is still makes sense to wear a mask in order to protect individuals who are more vulnerable. But certainly other spaces where it's much safer now to congregate without masks.
I wanted to ask you about that because you work with people who are receiving transplants. They obviously want to be very careful. How about people around them, family members, coworkers? Is this something where, you know, that 1 or 2 degrees of separation wearing masks can help help those people who are particularly vulnerable?
Absolutely. We do know that patients who have compromised immune systems may get COVID from their close contacts, so family members and loved ones. And so those people are rightly concerned about developing COVID, even that might not make them very sick, but could pass on even a fatal infection to their loved one.
Now, I mentioned changes in CDC guidelines, and that can be a little confusing to me, I'll admit, to a lot of people. I think in the latest CDC guidelines, what do you see when it comes to their priorities?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think most people heard from the CDC guidelines, quote, you don't need to wear masks anymore. And in fact, you know, if you're out wearing masks in public, people may confront you with that information. But I think it's important to know that the real truth is the CDC guidelines have changed their goal. So in the beginning, the goal was to prevent cases of COVID. And with the new guidance, that's no longer the goal. The goal isn't to prevent any cases. It's to prevent serious illness and death in the general public. So as I mentioned, if you are vaccinated, it is absolutely and boosted, it is absolutely true that your risk of acute serious illness and death are decreased. That isn't true for everyone, and that's why masks are important for immunocompromised individuals.
We're talking to Dr. Janina Smith, Associate Professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Medical Director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics, talking about the latest advisories on masks, moves away from mask mandates at the state and local levels. You can join in with your thoughts at 800 or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kim is with us in Madison. Kim, hi.
Hi. I'm calling specifically to talk about types of masks. My understanding is that with the infectiousness of Omicron, that a cloth mask really does nothing to stop the spread. And so it would not be worth anything for anyone to wear a cloth mask, and that a paper mask isn't that effective against these highly contagious variants. So A, if we were to go back to masking again, is the CDC going to clarify what type of mask we should wear? And B, would a good tactic be to make sure that every immunocompromised person or person at risk of being sick has a supply of KN95s or N95s for them to wear to protect themselves? Because I think people still think if they put on a cloth mask, they're protecting the people they're around, and my understanding is that now with Omicron, you really aren't doing that. And that's my question.
Kim, thanks for the call. Dr. Smith, the kind of masks we wear when we wear them.
Absolutely. The quality of mask matters. I'm not certain that I would agree that a cloth mask does nothing, but I would grade it in terms of the protection provided as cloth mask under a paper or surgical mask, under a type of mask like an N95 or KN95. It is true that the gold standard of protection is a fit-tested N95 mask. And I can say personally that I have worn the fit-tested N95 mask at the bedside of COVID patients throughout the pandemic. And myself and my colleagues have not gotten COVID in that setting. And so they are quite protective. In fact, the CDC just released a study this week that showed that if you wore a high quality mask, KN95 or N95, your risk was reduced over 80% from people who are not masked. So I do think the quality of mask matters. And it is something that we're researching within our own transplant program, whether we can provide our patients with higher quality masks. But there are programs that are available to get high quality masks through donations if they can't be afforded or purchased from reputable sources.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Janina Smith, Associate Professor at the UW School of Medicine, Medical Director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics, talking to us about the end of mask mandates in pretty much every state. Hawaii still has one, not for too much longer. A lot of local governments ending theirs as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone close to you immunocompromised? Is that affecting your decisions on mask wearing and your thoughts on whether or not other people wear masks? What questions do you have about the latest guidelines on COVID safety? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Janina Smith, Associate Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Medical Director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. We're talking about why mask mandates almost everywhere have been lifted and when we still might want to wear a mask. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And to you. What do you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, I wanted to give you a report north of Highway 8 in northern Wisconsin where I deliver. I go through a lot of businesses, you know, restaurants, gas stations, grocery stores, things like that. And where places that want you to wear a mask, they'll even provide one at the customer service desk. But it seems to be a personal choice. I keep one in my glove box. So when I use my own judgment, when I go into a place, I'll wear a mask. But for the most part, northern Wisconsin is kind of like you're on your own. If you want to wear one, you can, but at restaurants, they're not required. But some places, like a dentist office, or we had the president visit last week, that was required for his visit to University of Wisconsin Superior. But otherwise, it's kind of a case-by-case basis.
Jeff, thanks a lot for sharing the report from Superior and your delivery area. Dr. Smith, for people who own businesses or run offices, things like that, what would you say to them about suggested or required mask wearing?
What I would like to see, if I was allowed to suggest to businesses, is protection in safe spaces, places like grocery stores, pharmacies, the dentist office, as he mentioned, where we do know that it protects you to wear a mask yourself, but the protection is even better when both people are wearing masks. So I would like for there to be safe spaces for my patients. On the other hand, when you're talking about wearing a mask to walk into a restaurant only to sit down and remove your mask to eat, I think that borders on ridiculous. So I agree that in those settings, it's just silly to wear a mask when you're going to take your mask off in a moment.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Barb in Tomahawk. Barb, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, the CDC has decided that masking is unnecessary, but I'm wondering if anyone is still tracing long-haul COVID symptoms from the variants that are circulating now. Is that still an issue? Is anyone tracking long-haul COVID from new disease or any of the side effects that come from COVID?
Barb, thanks for the call. Dr. Smith, I know there's been a lot of talk about long COVID and people who had the disease, especially earlier. Still a concern, I imagine, for someone who might catch it today.
Absolutely. There's no evidence that there's a reduced risk of long COVID if you're experiencing the virus for the first time now. For example, if you're not vaccinated and haven't had prior COVID. So there's many reasons why someone may choose to still wear a mask. Of course, there's the protection of our fellow citizens, but even for protecting you, we certainly have seen individuals who had adverse effects of COVID. Though it's rare to get so seriously ill that you're hospitalized or die, you can still get really, really sick. And then that's not considering the consequences of long COVID. It does look like long COVID is less common if you've been vaccinated, but it still occurs. And we're still on just the beginnings of studying the impact of long COVID. And I think it's reasonable for that to be something you're quite concerned about. There's new data that's excellent, that within the first year after having COVID, the risks of cardiovascular events like heart attacks, strokes, goes way up for an entire year. There was just a publication in Nature Medicine last week that showed that there are brain changes that occur even in mild COVID. So there's plenty of reasons to not want to get COVID, even if you won't get seriously ill or die. In addition, masks are extremely effective at reducing other viral infections. We saw that when mask mandates were in place, influenza absolutely fell to the bottom. There was almost no cases and no serious consequences. I will tell you personally, I sure like not getting viral infections, not getting influenza. And so I am comfortable masking to protect myself.
Thanks for that call. Bob joins us now in Oconomowoc. Bob, hi.
Hi, love the show. My wife and I are both vaxxed and boosted, as are our son and daughter-in-law. And this weekend, we're going to visit a newly born grandson. Should we wear masks?
Bob, congrats on the grandson. But of course, that grandson, Dr. Smith, can't be vaccinated under age five. What are your thoughts for Bob?
Well, I have one great piece of news to Bob, is that his daughter or daughter-in-law, by vaccinating herself prior to delivering that newborn, has really done a great thing in terms of protecting the baby. Mothers pass antibodies from vaccination, both through their placenta and then through their breast milk. And so the baby will be more protected. I would say another option is to get an over-the-counter antigen test and test yourselves on the morning of your visit. If you're negative, it's very unlikely that you would transmit the infection to the baby during that same day.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bob. I wanted to take a few moments, Dr. Smith, to talk about the patients you work most directly with, people who are receiving transplants. Can you talk a little bit about why they are particularly vulnerable to COVID, even if vaccinated?
Yeah, so the medicines that we give patients when they get a transplant are intended so that their immune system can't make new reactions to new foreign invaders. This is because we don't want their immune system to recognize the transplant as something foreign and something that needs to be fought against. But unfortunately, our medications aren't specific just for the transplant, and they do make it so that the person can't fight other new foreign invaders very well either. And so it's something that we're doing on purpose to their immune system. But then when we give them a vaccine, their immune system doesn't have as robust a response. In fact, in some cases, doesn't have much of a response at all. Now, to combat that, we've done a couple things. We've increased the number of vaccines. So, for example, for most immunocompromised patients, the current recommendation is 4. So 3 vaccines as part of the primary series, and then a 4th vaccine. But because they aren't able to mount an immune response, when they get COVID, the odds of something bad happening, very bad, go way up. So we know from the largest study, which was 1,800 individuals after transplant who were fully vaccinated, the risk of developing COVID was increased by 80 times. But the worst part is that if they got COVID, they had a 50-50 chance of winding up in the hospital and a 1 in 10 chance of dying. And so that's the reason why, you know, I do urge people to consider that when, even though they may not get very sick themselves with COVID, even though they may not get long COVID, they could actually kill one of my patients.
And Dr. Smith, in our last few moments, as you mentioned earlier, the COVID trends, the numbers are looking pretty good right now, but we've been here before. Do you have concerns just briefly about the potential risk of new variants coming along?
I do, unfortunately. What we've seen in China and Hong Kong and in Europe is that there's been the emergence of the second Omicron variant, the BA2, which is causing increased caseloads and in some cases, severe illness and death. While we don't know for sure that we'll see a similar surge, and there's some reasons to think we might not because of our very severe original Omicron surge, there's still concern because we have tended to mimic Europe through most of these outbreaks.
Dr. Smith, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for bringing up this important topic.
Dr. Janina Smith is an associate professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and medical director of the Transplant Infectious Disease Program at UW Hospitals and Clinics. She talked to us about why most states have lifted their mask mandates. This week, WPR is marking 2 years of the pandemic in Wisconsin with stories about how COVID-19 has changed us in lasting ways. Starting in March 2020, healthcare workers were praised as heroes. But as Bridget Bowden reports, 2 years into the pandemic, burnout in the healthcare field is higher than ever.
Before March of 2020, Madison nurse Shamaria Russell was working in a psychiatric ward. The first big change happened for her shortly after the coronavirus pandemic hit Wisconsin, when she was transferred to a general care unit.
Pretty much nurses were pulled from everywhere. It didn't matter what your specialty was or whether you had a lot of experience.
Now, she primarily treats COVID patients. She says the pandemic has brought a lot of lasting changes in healthcare, like telehealth. But the biggest effect she's seen for healthcare workers is burnout and other mental health issues.
The nurses who have been working in the thick of everything the last 2 years, we really got to be aware that their mental health may be destroyed at some point.
According to a 2021 survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 62% of frontline healthcare workers say COVID-related stress has had a negative impact on their mental health. Russell says when treating COVID patients, it's difficult to mentally separate from work at the end of the day.
We're always sitting here thinking like, oh my God, did this person make it through the night? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, especially if the patient is really, really sick. And you know, carrying that type of weight around is mentally exhausting.
She says she's worried that a generation of healthcare workers will suffer because of what they've been through in the pandemic. UW-Madison School of Nursing clinical professor Sarah Endicott shares Russell's concern. She teaches a nursing theory class for nurses who are advancing their careers.
Which is typically a pretty straightforward, I don't want to say boring, but it's not usually everyone's favorite class. And the emotion that was coming out of students in a place where they could talk about what was happening to them.
She says dealing with people who are not taking measures to slow the virus's spread, like getting vaccinated, can be frustrating and hurtful.
The nurses who are witnessing what's really happening in the worst of the worst situations of the pandemic feel very isolated from their communities and from others who don't realize what they're going through.
One potential consequence of this mental toll is people leaving the healthcare field, says Wisconsin Hospital Association Senior Vice President Ann Zank. A new report from the association says registered nurse vacancies are at their highest level since 2005. Zank worries it's a threat to institutional knowledge.
Hospitals and health systems and their workforce have to work really hard to figure out, okay, how are we going to preserve the institutional knowledge? And also, how are we going to respond to a younger generation making up the majority of our workforce?
Patricia Tellez-Giron is a professor of family medicine at UW-Madison. She says they've been lucky to not lose any staff at the clinic where she practices.
But I think it was beautiful just to see how we all came together, you know, in the medical field and say, how can we help?
Still, it's been an exhausting 2 years, she says. And as far as what healthcare workers need most, well, she has some ideas.
We need a massage to start with. Now that maybe things are a little bit under control, right? To say, we really thank you for what you have done.
Beyond that, she says more flexibility, more time with patients, and better pay would help ensure Wisconsin's healthcare future. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, Russian President Vladimir Putin has taken issue with NATO expansion in Eastern Europe. We'll talk about the history of NATO and its role in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.